the Haggadah on Seder night. I think we're all very sort of familiar and habituated to the idea that, you know, the role of Moshe Rabbeinu is really minimized at the Seder. And part of the reason for that, and I very much believe this to be the case, is that we're looking to stress, of course, that Moshe, who played a very important role as Hashem's shaliach, as the agent, is not the same as Hashem. And that was something that the Jewish people, of course, struggled with throughout their 40 years in the desert. And what's the role of Hashem? And, you know, how does Moshe fit into that? There were certain moments of clarity. Kriyas Yam Suf definitely comes to mind. When the Torah tells us, Vayaminu b'Hashem uva Moshe avdo, they recognize that Moshe was in Eved Hashem, but he wasn't driving these events. But the particular emphasis on Leil HaSeder is, as we say, Anivalo Malach, Anivalo Saraf, Anivalo HaShaliach. So, you know, Moshe's role is commensurately reduced because, you know, we're looking to amplify and really focus on, you know, the Yad Chazakah, Uzro HaNetuya, and the fact that Hashem himself, Vahashem Hikakol Bechor Beretz Mitzrayim, Bechor Paro HaYoshev Al-Kiso, Ad Bechor HaShivcha, Asher Achar Echayim, Bechol Bechor Beimam, that Hashem directly, without any intermediary, came to our rescue. You know, and that's something that I still very much believe. That being said, in reflecting on tonight's topic, it occurred to me that there is a very, very strong emphasis at the Seder, if not on Moshe Rabbeinu, on two other figures, on Avraham Avinu, which we won't talk about tonight, but obviously the first indication of Egyptian slavery is at the Bris Ben Abisarim to Avraham Avinu, Yadoa Teda Ki Ger Yezarecha Beretz Lo Lahem, and arguably an even greater emphasis on the role of Yaakov Avinu, in particular, Yaakov's confrontation with Lavan. Tzei Ulamad, as we say before, the critical part of the Haggadah, Arami Oved Avi, Tzei Ulamad, Mabikesh Lavan Harami Lasos Liyaakov Avinu, Paro Logazar El Al Hazacharim, Paro only decreed against the males, Shenemar Kol HaBen HaYilod HaYoret HaShlichu V'Chol HaBas Tzichayun, V'Lavan Bikesh La'akor Es HaKol. Lavan wanted to destroy everyone. He wanted to destroy us all, and then we go into Shene'emar Arami Oved Avi Vayered Mitzrayim, which is really the heart of the mitzvah of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, as is detailed in the Mishnah in Arvei Pesachim. So we take a step back. We have a really remarkable phenomenon. Moshe's role is really downplayed, and of course he's the protagonist, you know, in the present. He's the one who is involved in the story, but it's not as if the role of humans is somehow insignificant, you know, at the Seder. It's just that Moshe isn't the one that we're focused on. In fact, Yaakov has a much more prominent role at the Seder, and in particular, as I say, Yaakov's confrontation with Lavan is kind of a point of departure for our entire understanding of what becomes Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. And that, I think, is noteworthy in its own right. But what is even more striking is the way that Yaakov is presented. As we say, you know, if I wanted to dramatize, you know, the importance of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, if I really wanted to make a big deal of, you know, just how important it was that we got out of Egypt, what I would do is I would say, you know, Paro was the worst of the worst, you know, and things were more desperate than ever before, and, you know, Hashem came to our rescue. But what do? We say, nah, you know, Paro wasn't that bad. You know what was really bad? Lavan. So, like, you know, just in case anybody's still paying attention by that point in time, we hope, right? People should say, wait a second, I thought the point here was to tell the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim, right? Like, we should be saying, like, Paro is, like, you know, he's really awful, you know, but that's not what we say. Instead, he pales in comparison, you know, as, like, an evildoer to Lavan. You know, Paro, that was child's play. No pun intended, right? Logazar ala zacharim, but Lavan, yeah, that was real trouble. So this is like highly counterintuitive. And so I've spent like a good part of the last week really just, you know, thinking and researching, you know, this question and to try to gain a little bit of understanding as to why Yaakov, and like I say, Yaakov's confrontation with Lavan, you know, plays such an important role. But before I go any further, good to see Sister. Sister just checked in. Starting to get nervous, you know, we worry sometimes, you know, big brothers tend to worry, you know, you can't take that out of us, no matter, you know, how much time goes by. Okay, so it's good to see you. let me ask you, meaning you, the entire Zoom group, what do we make of this? What have people thought about in the past when we, you know, all of a sudden like minimize the threat that Paro represented, and instead, you know, I don't want to say exaggerate, but really amplify Lavan and how, you know, frightening that was. And even though Moshe, you know, is basically erased from the entire Leil HaSeder, that Yaakov plays a dramatic role. Arami Oved Avi, you know, Lavan Arma'a, as the Targum Unkla says, you know, Bikesh La'abed Yas Abba, that he tried to destroy Yaakov Avinu. Yaakov plays an enormously important role in the heart of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. So how do we relate to that? Let's get some suggestions. Okay, Effie, we can always trust you to bat lead off. Effie is always the one to break the ice for us on Monday nights.
All I can say is what the Haggadah says. I mean, Lavan would have had an easier time destroying the Jewish people because there was just Yaakov at that point, which makes it a much more potential disaster than trying to get rid of thousands and thousands of people.
Okay, so that is like a critical insight. I hope everybody's appreciating what Effie is saying. Effie is putting it in more pragmatic terms, but what Effie's actually highlighting is a really critical point that I want to return to in just a little bit, that Yaakov is a kind of a microcosm of everything that we experience in terms of, you know, Shibud Mitzrayim, as we're going to try to detail, that Yaakov, in many ways, was a Yachid, and we're experiencing Paro as a nation. In fact, just to, Effie, if I can, I'm going to put words in your mouth, but just to try to embellish this point a little bit, right? We know that Paro is the first person in the entire Torah to refer to the Jewish people as a nation. That was a critical part of his approach, right? Hine am b'nei Yisrael, rav yatzu mimenu. If we're just a family, it's hard to, you know, fear-monger about us. If you say that there's this really dangerous family out there, even if they're one of the five families of New York City, it's not that scary. They're just a family, you know? But, you know, if they're a nation, that's the other. You know, that can be very frightening. So, Hine am b'nei Yisrael, rav atzumi menu. Am b'nei Yisrael means that they're, you know, a nation, and they're not our nation, and, you know, we're threatened by them. Okay, so that's a very important insight. And I really want to try to get back to there. Okay, so the Effie, beautifully done. Who is next? Ruthie? Is that you? And then I see my father. Let's get all the comments that we can.
I remember hearing, but I can't remember all the details, that, you know, depending on how you count the years, you could count the Shibud as starting from Yaakov when he was kind of, you know, sent away from home and was made to suffer in Lavan's house. I can't remember the specifics.
Okay, very good. So this is another very important point. So Ruthie, we're going to return to what you said, just like we'll return to what Effie said, that in many ways, the Bris Ben Abisarim itself, Yadoa Teda Ki Ger Yezer Acha Beretz Lo Lahem Vavadum Vinu Osam, is actually a nevuah about Yaakov Avinu. Now, there are many that point this out. The Ritva, in his commentary on the Haggadah, has this comment. The Abudram also emphasizes that in his commentary on the Haggadah. So Ruthie, you're in very good company. I like to believe the Ritva and the Abudram would say the same. You know, but there's a lot of evidence that Yadoa Teda actually begins chronologically with Yitzchak, but is experienced first by Yaakov. Okay, that's very important. I think Dad was next, and then Alana after that.
Yeah, really just, you know, taking off on Effie's point that the Jewish people have lots of experience with being oppressed, and hence Jews should always be optimistic. I mean, it's the same story that Effie told about the Haggadah, right? You know, the Jews had it worse previously. With Lavan, you know, they had a more difficult situation, just like our generation. You know, we have it a lot better than the previous generation had it. So Jews should always be optimistic.
Okay, very good. So maybe, you know, just a way of taking what my father said and putting it back together with what Evie said. So, like, you know, Yaakov is the first, maybe like the, you know, the primordial Jewish experience. I like that idea very much. And, you know, his experience becomes like the touchstone for everything that happened. And my father's adding to that. So, you know, it's not like we're minimizing what Paro did for just, you know, its own sake, but we're trying to put things in perspective. And we're saying, look, you know, this is something that we've been through in the past. And in some ways, the threat was even greater there. And so there's a way of, you know, like keeping things in perspective. Just to highlight that point, and I think there's a lot of merit to this kind of an approach, right? We do zoom out of the Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim story on other occasions. We say things like, Bechol Dor Vador, Omdim Aleinu L'chal Oseinu, where we demonstrate, you know, that we have this like broader panoramic historical perspective, which allows us to see that, you know, the Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim is but one chapter in this epic. And arguably the, you know, the first chapter is the chapter of Yaakov. So I think that sort of captures everything that's been said on this to this point. Let's go over to Ulana, get her take.
No, I was just going to say something very similar. Like, it seems like the Haggadah is presenting it as like a continuum, that there's, you know, it, like it says in the Haggadah also, like in every generation, somebody comes and tries to destroy us. Like, so it seems like, I mean, what building off of what Dr. Frimgen said also, like it seems like there is, you know, and you were saying, like, it seems like there's Lavan. I don't know if he's the first, but, you know, it's interesting why he's thought of as the first also, like why the Haggadah are bringing him up as the first. But, like, it seems like it's the Haggadah sort of presenting it as a continuum of suffering through the ages. And something that, in some ways, you can say optimistic, but on the other hand, something that's never really resolved. So I think that's also interesting.
Okay, very good. And so we do have to talk about that. We've talked about Yaakov as the beginning, but how exactly does this end? So I think that's like an extremely important idea. And I want to come back to that, you know, tonight towards the conclusion, because Alana, I think you've actually asked the question. It's like, what ultimately is the significance in terms of this frame shift over from Moshe to Yaakov? How does that both expand the story in terms of the chronological window is now dramatically expanded, because we're really going way back before, right, Yetzias Mitzrayim, even before we came down to Egypt. But what does that mean in terms of the ending? And I think that it actually changes the ending pretty dramatically. We all know that there's this, you know, huge emphasis on the narrative arc of Yetzias Mitzrayim. That's one of the, Chaim famously said, that's one of the differentiating factors of Sipur from Zechira, is this Maschal B'gnos and Messiah B'Shevach, that we're supposed to start with the denigration and we're supposed to conclude with the exaltation. And there's a dispute in the Gemara between Rav and Shmuel. What exactly does that mean? Does that mean our theological debasement? Does that mean avadim hayinu? So we paskin like both views, and that's why we say both of those things. And the conclusion would then be not only, you know, me'avdus l'cheiros, but ve'achshav kirvanu amakom l'avodaso. So I think that's all true, but I think that in light of Alana's comment, there's actually much more than that. There's something of an even greater conclusion that we can achieve, you know, by virtue of like bringing Yaakov and Lavan into the discussion. Okay, so I see a hand on MB. I feel like this is initial baseball. Like I should be able to, like, you know, to guess, you know, who.
Hi.
You know.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
It's Miriam Berman.
Okay. Very good. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. I just thought maybe since the point about the Zecharim was about the children, maybe that has to do with Lavan's trying to own the kids, like he tried to do that with Yaakov when he ran after them. He said, all the kids are mine.
Yeah.
And also Bakol, the word Bakol is also used with Abraham. And I'm trying to remember the context, but it says Hashem Beirech Barachat Abraham Bakol. And that was also, does Rashi say that has to do with children also?
Yeah, right. Bakol, Gematria is Ben. Yeah, exactly. There you go.
So maybe that has something to do with it. I don't know.
Okay, excellent. Okay, so all very important points. You should know, Miriam, the Perush HaKadmon, again, one of the very important Rishonim on the Haggadah, he says that. He says that's exactly what it means. When it says, with love on BK Shlakor Esakol, he references the pasuk that you did. Habanos Binosai, Vabanim Banai, V'chol Asher Ata Ro'eh, Lihu. Everything is really mine. Okay, that's a really important point. So, Baruch Shekivant, that's exactly right, that Lavan was staking a claim to the identity. I mean, the truth is the daughters actually were really his, right, in some sense. You know, that there's like a kernel of truth in that. And, you know, B'nei Vanim Harayim Kivanim, so, you know, you could argue the grandchildren were kind of his too, you know. But not like, you know, more so than Yaakov. So it's a very complicated interaction that they had. But that actually is the way the Perush HaKadmon understands Lavan Bikesh Lakor Esakol, he wanted to deny, you know, Yaakov's aspiration to build a family, which would then become a nation, which is a really interesting way of thinking about Lavan. Alana, you had asked, like, what makes Lavan so special? So if you, Miriam's insight is a very important one, that Lavan, what he tried to do was to deny Yaakov's aspiration to even build his own family, right? Habanim abanos benosai, abanim banai. So Paro says, you know, these people, these Jews, they're other, we've got to destroy them. In some sense, Lavan went even beyond that, right? He denied the fact that we could even be our own distinct people. You know, v'hameven yavin, there's something going on in the world today where, you know, the sort of the causus belli, you know, according to this, you know, madman, is that there's a nation that doesn't really exist, right? He denies the very concept of their existence as a separate people, which then, you know, potentiates all kinds of, you know, behaviors. It's a very fascinating thing. That's what Lavan wants to do to Yaakov. He says that you don't really exist as a separate entity. And that was a big part of the struggle. Now I want to sort of like go back to that now, right? You know, Yaakov, when he calls Rachel and Leah out to the field to have this conversation with them, you know, he says, "Mataya seg gam anochi levesi." I want to build up my own house. And I feel that here in Aram, I just can't do that, that everything is co-opted by Lavan, becomes this very fascinating point in terms of like building up the incipient Jewish family, which will then, of course, become the nuclear framework for the expansion into the Jewish people. Okay, so I think we've raised a lot of really important points. I want to get into a little bit of Yaakov's experience, you know, within the Beis Lavan, and how, in many ways, it really is the first iteration of the vision of Yadoa Tedar, of the Bris Bein Abisarim, and the ultimate, you know, Maase Avos Siman Labanim, you know, maybe even more so than the experience that Avram had when Avram went down to Egypt because of the Rav, and the famous essay the Ramban has in Parshas Lech Lecha about that being sort of the basis for Jewish slavery. So if we think about it, let's just try to document this in five or six different ways. So, you know, Yaakov goes to Aram under what kind of circumstances? Is he, you know, he goes out of a, you know, a sense of exploration, adventure, leisure. As they say at customs, what is the purpose of your visit, right? So what was the purpose of his visit? Literally, he was, you know.
Run away.
Right, he was seeking asylum, okay?
I mean, what?
Yeah, he was trying to save his life, right? You know, Yikruvu Yimei Evel Aviv, Argas Yaakov Achi, that, of course, Esav had said that his goal was to kill Yaakov as soon as he possibly could. So, you know, at his mother's behest, you know, he was sent to Aram. Now, it's interesting because there's a second dimension to that. If you look at the end of Parshas Toldos, it's not only a life-saving mission, but it's given sort of a different vector at the end of Parshas Toldos. Really, we know what it is. You know, Rivka has to get Yaakov out of there, but she very wisely, right, insinuates to Yitzchak that there's a different reason that Yaakov needs to go to Aram, okay? And it's really this duality that I want to try to develop, right? Go ahead. Who's sorry? Somebody started. Ruthie, go ahead.
To find a wife.
Yeah, right. To build up a family, okay? So there's both, like, you might say, negative and positive reasons. That's not the most articulate way of pointing it, but you understand what I'm saying. Yaakov goes at the beginning to the Beis Lavan both to avoid, right, a kind of a disaster, right, both because he's in duress, but also because somehow this is necessary for his development, that he needs to marry and build up a family, which is what we were just talking about, how critical that really is, you know, and how challenging that is, because everything that he does is under the guise, as, you know, Miriam was pointing out, of Avanos Benosai, Avanim Banai, Vatzon Sani, V'chlasher Taroel Lihu. How is he supposed to do that with somebody who wouldn't let him grow, you know, into his own person? Now, if you think about the Jewish people, this is just point one of the comparison, we went down to Egypt, of course, under duress. We went to literally save, you know, our lives. Namely, there was a Ra'av, and there was, you know, Vayar Yaakov, Kiyei Shever B'Mitzrayim. So part of it, of course, was, you know, simply to, you know, save our lives. There was no way that we could survive, you know, in Canaan. But at the same time, what was the second reason? This is just really interesting when you think about it, right? The way that the story plays out, what was the other reason that we went down to, what does Yaakov say about going down to Egypt? he has a very compelling family reason to go to Egypt, namely that this will bring the family back together, right? El chaverenu b'terem amus. There's a need to reunite the family that's been torn asunder by Mechiras Yosef. So this is a very strange thing. But, you know, you say, like, well, what is the purpose of this visit, right? If you said to Yaakov, you know, on the one hand, it's to save his life. On the other hand, right, it's there's a very persuasive and compelling family reason. And then the same thing plays out in this fascinating dialectic with the Jewish people. On the one hand, right, they're trying to save their lives, right, trying to avoid a famine. On the other hand, there's this really compelling and important family reason. They need to be reunited together with Yosef. Now, in terms of the language of Shibud Mitzrayim, we know that the two critical words are again foretold in the Bris Bein Abisarim, Vavadum V'inu Osam, that there'll be Avadim in Egypt and there will be, you know, Inui. And of course, that language first occurs in the Torah in practice in terms of describing Yaakov's experience in the Beis Lavan. Es onyi v'esigia kapai ra'o elokim v'yochach amesh. Yaakov, you know, ki v'chol kolchi avadti es avichen. He described himself as an eved b'veis lavan, and as we just spoke about, es onyi, so v'avadum v'inu osam ki em bo. That he experienced that sense of being an eved, an inui, in the beis lavan. Not only that, but on his way out, remember what happens. You know, Yaakov runs away, and the way that the story goes, that there's a three-day distance that exists between, you know, Yaakov and Lavan towards the end of Parshas Vayetze because of all of the sheep. And then, you know, Vaignov Yaakov is Lev Lavan Harami. Lavan doesn't really understand what's going on, that Lavan, you know, that Yaakov is going to make a break for the land of Israel, and he chases after him. This is building up to the scene that Miriam was talking about a few moments ago. And Vaya Bekoso Behara Gilad, he catches him pressed up, you know, against the mountain. He chases after him for those, you know, 3 days, right? The same thing happens, of course, you know, when the Jewish people, at the beginning of Parshas Bishalach, you know, they begin their process of running away, and Paro says, Nevuchim heim ba'aretz, sagar lehem ba'midbar, you know, vayirdof Paro achreihem, etc. So Paro leads the Jewish people, leads Mitzrim after the Jewish people, and the Jewish people are caught up against the sea, and then there's this great moment of salvation in both cases. So the story from beginning to end really seems to be, like, eerily similar, right? It seems to be like an iteration of the Avadim Vinu Osam, and we know that the Achrei Chen Yetzu B'Rechosh Gadol, that the Jewish people would leave Egypt as they did with an enormous amount of wealth. Well, that's exactly what happened to Yaakov, right? At the beginning of Parshas Vayishlach, we get just a small sense of how much wealth Yaakov left with when he says, you know, Ki v'makli avarti es hayarden hazeh ve'ata hayisi lishnei machanos. Right? The idea of Yaakov having left with almost nothing as totally indigent as a pauper, and he comes back, you know, just look at the mincha that he sends Esav, Gimalim, and, you know, Atonos, and he's the everything under the sun, you know, is part of that mincha, so it's very clear that V'achrei Chen Yetzu B'Rechosh Gadol, and the Perish HaKadmon also makes that point, you know, in his commentary. So Yaakov, in many ways, had this microcosmic personal experience of what we would later experience as a nation in terms of Mitzrayim. But as we said before, even if there were, in both cases, like really existential reasons that we needed to go into Galus, Yaakov needed to get away from Esau, the Jewish people needed food to eat, right? In the end, there was also something very important and developmental in both cases. Yaakov needed to build up his own family, which he does. Virtually the entire family is born in Aram, except Binyamin. And then, of course, we have the parallel. The Jewish people really are forged into a nation in the Kor HaBarzel in Mitzrayim, just like they started out with an attempt to reunite as a family successfully. And from there, Uvnei Yisrael, Paru, Vayishritzu, Vayirbu, Vayatzmu, Bimod, Meod, right? They multiply very much along the lines that, you know, Yaakov Avinu experienced this great multiplication in the Beis Lavan. So I think we see, you know, that the Yaakov Avinu experience becomes paradigmatic, you know, for what later happened with the Jewish people. And, you know, it's no surprise, you know, that we would then reference, you know, back to Yaakov's experience at the beginning, and to say that even though, you know, we tell the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim as sort of our narrative, our birth story as a people, the truth of the matter is that our birth story as a people is, you know, is rooted in our history as a family. And that history really begins with the one who's the father of us all, Kulanu b'nei Isha Echad Nachnu, that raises the profile of Yaakov. And I think it's very sensible within that framework and from that perspective that Yaakov would, you know, take on, you know, like a really, really significant role, you know, within the framework of Yetzias Mitzrayim, a kind of an antecedent on the one hand, but also, as we'll now shift our attention to, a way of, I think, reimagining the end, you know, of the Seder. As we mentioned before, and Alana helped point us in this direction, Yaakov obviously comes down to Egypt, both under duress, but also for compelling family reasons. And Yaakov lives in Egypt, as we know, Shiva Esrei Shana, Vayichi Yaakov Eretz Yitzrayim Shiva Esrei Shana, and then Yaakov, you know, reaches the end of his natural life. You know, he calls Yosef, and he says, of course, to Yosef that he has, you know, one last request, which is, what does Yaakov ask Yosef? I think this takes us to a very important place in terms of the Seder.
Bury me.
Bury him.
Right. So now you'll chat achas yirechiv asisa imadi chesed mes al na sik bereni b'mitzrayim. Right. And usasani b'mitzrayim b'kvaratani b'kvarasam. And Yosef says anochi asakid varachan. It's not enough. And he says yishavali v'yishavalo. And there's this critical scene. And then indeed, you know, so Yaakov dies, and there's this great, you know, avil kaveh l'mitzrayim, and Yaakov is buried, you know, in the land of Israel. Okay, so that's the end of Yaakov's personal story. Okay, now, anybody see how that might sort of reframe the way that we conclude Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, the way that we conclude Leil HaSeder, if we try to imagine things not just from sort of the narrative arc beginning with Avadim Hayinu, or, you know, an emphasis on that generation, but more like in terms of Yaakov's story, you know, what might that indicate? I think there are a couple of points to be drawn out here. Yeah, Effie, go ahead.
Well, Yaakov was in Mitzrayim, and at the end, he needs to leave Mitzrayim when everybody else leaves. So the story of Yaakov with Mitzrayim is the same parallels with Israel. He commands them to take him out.
Right. Okay, good. And so what do we do? Just, you know, just to, you're saying this implicitly, but just to...
Well, the Rami Oved Ovi, parallel love unto Paro, and then Yaakov to Bnei Israel, mm-hmm. coming out in the end.
Right, and what do we do at the end of the Seder? What's our sort of our final wish at the Seder?
Shana haba b'Yerushalayim.
Right, okay, exactly. So what we express this aspiration that we need to, you know, eventually, like Yaakov, we need to achieve this redemption. It may not happen in our lifetime, right? It didn't happen for Yaakov in his lifetime. But the idea is that as a people, we're kind of pointed in that direction. Yaakov's story, you know, points us in that direction. So that, I think, is like, you know, a little bit of low-hanging fruit, but important nonetheless. But let's try to take the, you know, the point a little different. Again, Alana raised the question. It's like, you know, how does this change maybe the ending of the story and not just the beginning of the story? It's Eulamad, Ma'abi Bikesh Lavan Lasos Yaakov Avinu. So if you go back, what we said was that Yaakov had to go to Aram to build a family. And on the one hand, he really succeeded in that. He had a lot of children. But on the other hand, he really couldn't establish an independent framework with Lavan, whereas Lavan was quite explicit in saying, Habanos Benosaya, Banim Banai, Vetzon Soni, V'chola Sheretah Roel Liyu. And Yaakov had to break free of that, Mataya Sagam Anochi Levesi. So this idea of Yaakov really trying very hard, not just to be the biological father of a family, but try to found this family in the image of the values that he inherits from Avram and Yitzchak is really a struggle for him in the house of Lavan. And he feels the need, as we say, to break free of that, kind of creating this model for what we experienced, you know, during our moment of breaking free, you know, in Kriyas Yamsuf. So what I think is really fascinating is if you think about the end of Yaakov's life, right, we know that Yaakov gathers all of his children together. Yaakov gathers his entire family together, and the Rambam really dramatizes this point in the beginning of Hilchos Kriyat Shema is based on the Gemara Pesachim and Daf Nun Vav. But does anybody remember the way that either the Rambam or the Gemara tells the story? That what's that interaction about at the end of Yaakov's life? And we'll, I think this will help us sort of reframe the Seder as well. That at the end of Yaakov's life, there's a strange thing. He says, I'm going to tell you what's going to happen in the Messianic era, and then nothing comes out, right? And the Gemara famously says that Yaakov Avinu somehow lost Ruach HaKodesh, Nistalka Hemenu Shechina. He lost the ability, you know, to be able to communicate. The Rambam, though, takes it very differently. The Rambam says that his whole point of departure in terms of speaking to his children was to be mitzavel mizares al yichud Hashem, that he wanted to make sure that he had what we call, you know, in the language of Chazal, a mita shlema, that all of his children were completely committed to yichud Hashem, and all of his children said, Shema Yisrael Hashem Elkeinu Hashem Echad, and Yaakov responds, Baruch Shem Kavod Malchus Sol Olam Va'ed, that everybody was, you know, committed, everybody was firm in their belief that, you know, God is one, and that they weren't, like, unfortunately it happened in previous generations, where Avram kind of lost Ishmael, at least temporarily, and Yitzchak kind of lost Esav. Yaakov was the one who was able to keep, you know, everybody together for all of their faults, and Reuven had his, and Shimon and Levi certainly had his, and Yehuda went through his dark times as well, but through all of their many faults, Yaakov was able to hold everybody, you know, onto the same page. Now, when I think about that, when I think about the Yaakov story and keeping, you know, all of the sons sort of together and keeping them, you know, part of the story, how does that resonate, of course, at the Seder? How does that sort of give us a framework for thinking about what we're seeking to accomplish? You know, again, we pointed out one parallel, Lashana Haba B'Yerushalayim, of Yaakov seeking to sort of point us back in the direction of Israel as our long-term goal. That was, you know, not something he lived to see. But if the end of Yaakov's life is defined by trying to keep all his sons within this Mita Shlema. Yeah, Eva, go ahead.
Well, the Seder really is when the family gets together and does it together. And it's, no matter where they are, you try to bring the family together to be one united as the Seder. Something unfortunately didn't work for us in this year, but
right.
You know, it used to be they'd travel long distances to come and be together.
You're not alone. Yeah, this is like, you know, endemic to the Seder experience. Eva, you're in good company. I'm sure there are many on this Zoom who are experiencing similar, you know, things with the grown children. Hard to get everybody together. But at least in principle, we know that, you know, one of the major, major themes of the Seder is this idea of trying to speak to all of the children, right? Keneged arba banim dibrei Torah, echad chacham ve'echad rasha, echad tam ve'echad sheino yodea lishol. And this idea of trying to make room for all of the children is sort of like critical to the, you know, the enterprise of trying to maintain a mita shlema, not claiming that everybody's perfect. In fact, we acknowledge that some of the kids are rishayim on some level, but we still have to find a way to include them to, you know, try to propagate this forward. So that was like the great, you know, success of Yaakov Avinu's life. It was that he didn't have an idea that Reuven, Shimon, or Levi, or Yehuda were perfect, but he saw that, you know, they had to be kept within the fold, and that was what he considered to be his greatest paternal success. And on the night of Igad to the Vincha by Yom Ahulei Mor, Yaakov becomes, right, a kind of a paradigm of this idea of Mita Shlema. Sister, I saw your hand just a second ago.
I was going to bring up the four sons.
Ah. Okay, excellent. So I like the idea very much. And I agree. So Yaakov, we know, you know, really becomes like a manifestation of this idea of the, like we call it, the Mita Shlema of Keneged Arba Banim, of the notion of you know, inclusion of all of the sons and trying to, you know, make them part of the Jewish story, even if we can all admit that there are flaws, gaping flaws, you know, wide, insuperable chasms. Nonetheless, right, the point is to, you know, make sure that everybody has a role. So I think that's extremely important as well. There's one sort of like final element of the Yaakov-Lavan confrontation that I just wanted to conclude with tonight in terms of I think, you know, why we can both start at this point, say Ulamad Mabikesh Lavan Arami Lasos Liakov Avinu, and how, like I say, it may in some sense change our appreciation of what's going on, you know, on Seder night. So again, the first point that we raised is sort of redirecting us towards Israel, L'shana haba b'Yerushalayim, which is definitely what Yaakov aspired to at the end. It's certainly the idea of, you know, Hey Asfu v'agida lacham Esa Sher Yikra Eschem b'acharis hayamim, which is also like critically important, the idea, you know, of keeping all of one's sons, you know, integrated, acknowledging that not everybody's going to achieve the same spiritual level, but the idea of, you know, a Judaism not just for the Chachamim, but on some level also for the Rishayim and the Tamim and Sheinam Yodim Lishol, etc., I think is a very important legacy of Yaakov Avinu. But there's a third point. If we go to Yaakov's specific time, you know, in Mitzrayim, which I think becomes like almost an indelible template for what's happening, you know, during the Haggadah. Okay, so anybody remember, we actually point this out, you know, during the Seder itself, is what was Yaakov's self-conception in Egypt? Now, of course, Yaakov came down to Egypt at 130. He left Egypt at 147. He left in a coffin. He didn't ever actually get back to Israel alive. But what was Yaakov's self-conception during those 17 years? And this actually we make explicit reference of based on the Sifrei in the Haggadah. It's actually included in the Haggadah. How did Yaakov understand himself? And this probably goes back to, you know, a much earlier time in his life, you know, when he was in the Beis Lavan.
Thought it was going to be temporary.
Very good. So what's, Effie, what's the line that I'm looking for? Exactly, right? Lo yarad Yaakov Avinu, excellent. Lishtakeh abimitzrayim alulagur sham, shenemar vayagur sham bimsei ma'at. That Yaakov's, you know, self-conception was, and again, you could argue, you know, this wasn't matched in reality, you know, maybe on some level he knew he would never make it back to Israel, but his self-conception always remained, you know, apart, right? Lagur baretz banu, which both indicated temporary, but also this, you know, resistance to, you know, assimilation. In fact, the Ramban points this out. He says that Yosef knew very well, you know, Goshen was, you know, great for cattle, but the Ramban thinks that the real reason that Yosef was so insistent on the family going to Goshen was out of Kibbutz Av. When the Ramban writes in his essay in Parshas Vayigash that Yosef knew that his father could never really imagine nor desire being part of the Egyptian culture, and that he would want to be separate and apart. He would want to be, you know, in the, you know, say whatever you, you know, in some version of Monroe, or you know he's not interested in being integrated with the ambient culture. Now, what I think is really fascinating about this is, let's go back for a second to Yaakov and Lavan. Yaakov ends up staying for 20 years. That's not a short time. Even if Yaakov lived 147 years, it's a very significant portion of his life. But what was his conception when he arrived? What was the, you know, What did his mother say to him? There's this incredible expression that comes up twice in Sefer Bereishis, which describes sort of the mission statement of Yaakov in the Beis Lavan. Rivka is the first one to articulate it. Right, so he says, very good. So, V'yashavta imo yamim achadim ad asher tashuv chamas achicha. That you shouldn't think, Yaakov, when you go to the Beis Lavan, that you're going to be, you know, you're going to apply for a green card, and then you're going to become, you know, a citizen, and you'll get a, you know, a Haran passport. No, that's not the goal here. V'yashav ta'imo yamim achadim ad asher tashuv chamas achicha. Now, it's really interesting. Anybody remember the only other time that expression occurs in the entire Torah? Yamim achadim? So,
yes.
Oh, go ahead, Miriam. Yeah.
Can't think of it.
Okay, so I know this is what you were going to say. So
something.
Right. So you hit the nail on the head. Right. So when Yaakov works for Rachel, vayu beinav ki amim achadim ba'avaso osa. So Miriam got it. Okay. So that what that pasuk really means, it means a lot of things.
I didn't really
get it. Well, I knew that's what you were thinking. So the point is that Yaakov thinks this is the fulfillment of his mother's wish. Right. because this must be the Yamim Achadim, the 7 years, so that I have to work to get my wife, to build up my family, and then I'll go back. Obviously, Lavan has other plans, and you know, Nisgalgil Hadavar, and all of a sudden Yamim Achadim turns into 7 years, and it turns into 20 years, and you know, it doesn't happen right away. Right? And so that same self-conception of Lagur Ba'aretz Banu, you know, we're just, people make a joke out of it, you know, I don't even want to say it, but, you know, sometimes people make a joke if you know, people come from Eretz Yisrael to America, they say, you know, we're here maybe for a year, and maybe it's been like 1 year times many, many multiples of that. But the point is, you know, that their self-conception is that they're always on their way back, right? That Lagur Ba'aretz Banu, right? We came for a year. Or maybe that was 35 years ago, but we came for a year. So I don't say it's a joke. I say on the contrary, right? It's actually a very beautiful thing. It's the tradition of Yaakov Avinu. It's the Yamim Achadim. It's Lagur Ba'aretz Banu, Lo Yared Yaakov Avinu Lishtakeh B'Mitzrayim, Elo Lagur Sham. And so this, I think, you know, sort of reframing the Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim in terms of Yaakov's personal story, so then I think that it becomes a very beautiful way of us, you know, thinking about, you know, Jewish history. It's true, it's been a long time, and since we experienced that particular geula, but we have this idea that it's just right, it's just around the corner. It's Yamim Achadim, Lagur Ba'aretz Banu, whether it's the case of Yaakov himself personally returning to the land of Israel, whether it's the famine being over. So, you know, we all know intellectually that things have a way of taking a little bit longer in practice. But in our own mind's eye, the way that our self-conception, the way that we think of ourselves, and I think this is really a Yaakov Avinu idea, is Lagur Ba'aretz Banu, right? That we're just here for a short amount of time, and, you know, right around the corner, it's the peace of the Yeshua, you know, we're going to have a sense of Vehevesi Eschem El Haaretz, Asher Nasasi Esyadi Laseso Saliavram Yitzchak Liyakov, Nasatio Salachem Morasha Ani Hashem. So this idea of, you know, seeing ourselves as temporary residents, you know, wherever we are, and always, you know, kind of, you know, being pointed, Yamim Achadim, it's sort of right around the corner, I think is like a major, maybe this is part of what my father also meant by optimism, it's a major part of our self-conception, you know. We can acknowledge that in the end of the day, it's been, you know, a number of millennia since the Jewish people, had a Beis HaMikdash and a Korban Pesach, etc. But, you know, as far as we're concerned, you know, it's right around the corner. It's Yamim Achadim. It's Lagur Ba'aretz Banu, it's the famine, the days of the famine will soon be over, and then, you know, we'll all go back up together, you know, as one family. So again, tonight we try to focus on the idea, you know, that the Jewish experience in Egypt was in many ways presaged by Yaakov's personal experience. He went both under duress, like we did with famine, but also because he needed to develop, he needed to build up a family. Just as we needed to reunite in the as a family, and you know, the experience was one of Avdus and Inui, and then he had to run after a certain amount of time, and he was Yotze Berchosh Gadol, all of the parallels that we delineated. We said the real value of this, we think, is, you know, not just, you know, Lishana Habab Yerushalayim, and it's not only the idea of Amita Shlema, of trying to be inclusive of Arba Banim, or maybe even Shnei Masar Banim or more. But like ultimately, I think it's a sort of an idea about our self-conception. Jews have made sedarim in many places, not just in North America, you know, and not just in Eastern Europe, and not just in North Africa, but in all of the above, and many different times and places. And this, I think, like you know, attitude of Yamim Achadim, Lagur Ba'aretz Banu, Lo Yared Yaakov Avinu Lishtakeh B'Mitzrayim, Elo Lagur Sham, the idea that the Yemei Hara'av are soon to conclude, and that we have, you know, some great national destiny ahead of us, I think is really an idea that is endemic to the life of Yaakov Avinu. He lives it twice over, first in his relative youth in Beis Lavan, then again as in the twilight of his life in terms of, you know, his descent into Egypt. And I think that even if there have been generation after generation of Jews who have known, you know, at some level intellectually, that they were not going to leave wherever they were, you know, themselves, they still maintained this self-conception heroically as lagur ba'aretz banu, yamim achadim. And that self-conception, even if it to some extent is in our mind's eye only, right, that I think is characteristic of our people, ma'minim b'nei ma'minim. It creates a framework for, you know, a geula and the Yeshua krova lavo, you know, v'tzidka sili galos, a kind of an aspirational view. And this, you know, like, is deeply rooted in the personal legacy of Yaakov Avinu. So in that respect, you know, maybe Yaakov becomes not just a great place for us to begin, say, ulamad, but also a great place for us to think about how the Seder concludes, whether, you know, or not, you know, we have immediate plans or less than immediate plans. Our self-conception for all times and in all places is really very much, you know, yamim achadim ad asher tashuv chamas achicha, that, you know, right around the corner, you know, things are going to come together for all of us. So if Moshe Rabbeinu, you know, his role is relatively diminished on the Al Seder, Yaakov Avinu's role is expanded. It really, like I say, expands the scope of Jewish history. Bechol Dor Vador, it takes us back to the very beginning, Kulanu B'nei Isha Chanachnu, Arami Oved Avi, the very beginning, which is the story of Yaakov, and gives us, I think, you know, a bit of a different perspective on how Leil HaSeder should play out. So again, I want to thank everybody for their really excellent participation. Gained a lot from all of your insights. Look forward to the third and final part of this Haggadah series next week as we build up towards Pesach. I want to wish everybody a wonderful night and a wonderful week, and hope to see you at the same time next week.
Thank you.
Thank you.